Poet Claribel Alegría cannot return to her home in El Salvador. That would be too dangerous. But in her poetry, she evokes the sounds and smells of her country. In exile, she writes about her friends who have been killed or tortured, and of babies mutilated by soldiers. In 1978, she won Latin America's most prestigious literary award, the Casa de las Américas Prize. Alegría was born in Nicaragua in 1924. Her father fought against the U.S. Marines there, and when she was 1 year old, her family moved to El Salvador. She first left El Salvador to attend college in the United States. While in school, she met Darwin Flakel, who later became her husband, and eventually collaborated with her on books about El Salvador and translated her poetry into English. Over the past 35 years, they've lived in several Latin American and European countries. Recently, they've been dividing their time between Managua, Nicaragua, and Mallorca, Spain. Claribel Alegría's most recent books are Luisa in Reality Land, a memoir about her childhood which combines prose and poetry, and a new book of poetry titled Woman of the River. I asked her to read a poem.
We were three, Tupaco and Rodolfo. It was winter. There was snow. It was night. This is a green day of doves and sun, of ashes and cries. The wind pushes me across the bridge, over the cracked earth, through a dry stream bed strewn with cans. Death comes to life here in the ya, the torrente, the stone bridge, my dead weight at every corner, the innocent grill work of balconies, the film mirror of my dead. They smile from the distance and wave to me. They leave the cemetery, a wall of the dead. My flesh emits light, and they come to my door waving their arms. The bridge was a stone. It was night. Our arms circle each other. We sway to our songs. Our breath rose from our mouth in a small, crystalline clouds. It was winter. There was snow. We were three. Today, the earth is dry and resounds like a drum. My arms fall to my sides. I am alone. My dead stand watch and send signals to me. They assail me in the radio and paper. The wall of my dead rises and reaches from Aconcagua to Izalco. The bridge was a stone. It was night. No one can say how they died. Their persecuted voices are one voice, dying by torture in prison. My dead arise. They rage. The streets are empty, but my dead wink at me. I am a cemetery. I have no country. And they are too many to bury.
Claribel Alegría, when was the last time that you were in El Salvador?
I was there in January of 1980.
And
for the last time.
Why haven't you been able to go back since then?
Because in March of 1980, Monsignor Romero was assassinated. I remember very well I was in Paris when I heard the news. I had been invited to the Sorbonne to give a reading of my poems. And instead of giving a reading of my poems, I talk about the assassination of Monsignor Romero. And I felt, and like me, many others felt, that we had to do something to fill the vacuum, the great vacuum that Monsignor had left in El Salvador. And so I decided to go ahead and write and denounce what was happening in El Salvador. And since then, of course, it's very dangerous for me to go there.
Are your books in print in El Salvador?
Yes, now there are. For a long time, there weren't any, except one, Ashes of Izalco, a novel that my husband and I wrote, a historical novel, that by sheer ignorance of the people of the government was let, you know, to serve as a textbook for high school. But then another one of my books of poetry was burned in 1972 at the University of El Salvador. It was the university who published it, and it was burned together with other books of other authors. But since about 2 years ago, the Catholic University of El Salvador, that is a Jesuit university, is publishing now the works of all of us. They have published Roque Dalton, and they have published Manuel Argueta, and they have published myself. So now my books are in print in El Salvador.
When you left El Salvador, you didn't. When you left for the first time, you really didn't intend to be in exile. You first left to go to college in America.
That's right. Oh, yes. For many years, my exile was voluntarily because I came to the United States to study. I went to George Washington University. I graduated from George Washington. I married in Washington and had three of my children there. We lived for about 11 years. I lived for 11 years in the United States. And then we went traveling all over. You know, we lived in Latin America and then in Paris, and we made our home later in Mallorca. And then when the revolution, the Sandinista revolution triumphed, we decided to come to Nicaragua to write a book. And it was at that time, at the end of 79, that I went to visit my mother in El Salvador. You know, and I was with her until the first days of January. And since then, I have not been able to come back.
You were born into two very different classes. Your father was a Nicaraguan, and he was a campesino, and he had fought against American Marines. And your mother was from the bourgeois class. She was middle class. There were landowners in her family, yes?
That's right. My father was from a campesino family who owned land, but he himself was a doctor. He was the only one of the 11 children who went to the university, and he was a medical doctor and a rebel, yes. He fought with Benjamin Celedon against the Yankee Marines. And my mother, as you said, she was from the bourgeoisie of El Salvador. And yes, my grandfather was a very, very rich man after he lost all his money, but he was from the oligarchy, you know, and he and his brothers were all educated in Europe, in the best universities in Paris and in Germany and all of that.
Did each side of the family exert a different pull on you?
Exactly, yes. Well, I was very good friend of both of them. They both were amazing people, very progressive people. My mother, in spite of being from the bourgeoisie, she always was thinking of the poor class, of the oppressed, and it hurt her very much to see how the oppressed class was in El Salvador. My father always taught me, you know, he taught me who Sandino was, for instance. I remember I was about 10 years old, and I was one day bathing at the sea when he came very pale, and he said to me, "Come, child, come, Sandino has been assassinated." And then I asked who Sandino was, and he explained to me who Somoza was, and how Somoza, with the North American minister, had, you know, planned the assassination of Sandino. And I remember that I was very shocked that day, and I swore that I was going to revenge somehow, I didn't know how, Sandino's death.
Gee, I wonder what you had in mind when you were young, what you were thinking of doing.
That's right, I was only 10 years old. I don't know what I had in mind. Probably writing.
You know, I know that when you were a child growing up in El Salvador, that there was a peasant uprising and the National Guard brought prisoners to a fortress which was right across the street from your house.
Right, yes.
Did you look out the window and see
yes,
prisoners
that
being
was
marched
another,
by?
That was another thing, Terry, that marked me very, very much. It was, as you said, my bedroom was right in front of the National Guard. And as a child, my brother and I, as children, you know, we would go to the window to see the street, and we saw these campesinos being brought there, you know, with their hands tied in the behind. And we saw as children how this Colonel Salinas would slap their faces. And my father, again, was so wonderful because one time he came out from his clinic, you know, and he was enraged, and he told the Colonel, you never do something like that. That's being a coward, to slap a man when he cannot defend himself. And I remember my heart jump, and I thought, this is it, my father is going to be killed. But no, nothing happened.
Did seeing that scare you, or did it more make you angry and want to take action?
It made me scared, and it made me anger at the same time. And I was a very curious child at the time, and I knew something terrible was happening in El Salvador, and I remember I wanted to listen to all the conversations that the grown-ups were having, and I have a beautiful nanny that was an Indian woman from Izalco, one of the places, the place where the great massacre took place, you know, where Martinez assassinated 30,000 peasants and Indians. And so my nanny was so sad, and she would tell me that practically all the men in Izalco were killed because Martinez thought that all the Indians were communists and he wanted to, you know, just completely mop them out. And so my nanny told me, you know, how so many of her relatives, the men relatives, would dress as women in order to flee this little town of Izalco and go somewhere else. And they decided not even to talk their language, that was the Nahuatl, anymore, because they were very much afraid of the persecution and that they were going to be killed. So I grew up with all of that bottle inside me. And one day, all of these souvenirs came to the surface, and I started writing about it.
This is when you were in America that you started writing?
Let me see where I was. I was in Europe.
So this was after you had graduated from college then?
That's right. When I was in America, I was a very lyrical, subjective poet, very individualistic, thinking about myself only and about my happinesses and about my sadness and about my interior landscape, you know? And it was it was in about 1962 when we moved to Paris at the end of 62 that I started writing about El Salvador.
So tell me again what brought all this to the surface? What brought the anger to the surface and the desire to write about El Salvador?
You know what I think it brought it out? I think it was because I thought that all of these dictatorships in Central America were inevitable, that they were going to go on, that nobody could stop them, you know, could do anything to change them. And so I started being a little blasé, I guess, about that, and just writing about myself and being preoccupied with myself. But then in 1959, the Cuban Revolution took place. And I was amazed about that, that a little country that was only 90 miles away from the United States could do that. And then in 62, as you recall, it was the invasion of the Bay of Pigs. And I was amazed again to see that, yes, that the Cubans were defending what they had. And so then I started being more aware of what was going around me in my countries, in my region. And then all of a sudden, all of these souvenirs that were inside me started being an obsession. And I kept talking and talking to my husband about my obsessions. And he was the one who told me, look, you have to write about that, otherwise you'll be sick. And that's when we realized, you know, that we had to write this novel, and we wrote this novel of Ashes of Izalco, that is a historical novel about the 1932 event, and nobody had written about that at all, because Martinez, you know, the dictator that did this massacre, had all of the newspaper of the epoch burned so that nobody would have anything. Nobody would write about that. And in the school books, it only says, oh, yes, in 1932, we had a revolution that was, that was not successful, and that was all. And so we were the first ones who wrote about that. And it was based only in my souvenirs and in three little clippings that my father kept, you know? And that's it.
You had mentioned before that your mother's side of the family was wealthy and that they supported the oligarchy. When you started writing poems that spoke out against the military in El Salvador, was your mother's side of the family angry with you? Did they think that you were a traitor to them?
Well, yes, especially when Cenizas, Ashes of Izalco was published, the novel, my mother's side of the family didn't like it at all. As a matter of fact, there were some distant aunts that, as the book was published first in Spain, and they asked for many books, you know, and then they burned them. And they told me, they didn't even spoke to me anymore, and they said I was a traitor. I am still considered by some members of my family a traitor to my class, and they don't like me at all.
Did that feeling that your family was going to consider you a traitor ever make you think twice about writing this poetry?
No, not at all. The only thing was my parents, and I remember I sent my parents the book of Ashes of Izalco, and I always, when they were alive, showed them my poems, and I always said, if there is something that you don't like, that you think is going to hurt you, I am not going to publish, just to my parents. And my parents said, don't be silly, both my mother and my father, go on saying what you have to say. And I am very grateful to them for that.
Well, you had mentioned that you started writing political poetry when you were living in Paris. Did that make you want to return to El Salvador again?
Very much. I want to return to El Salvador very much. And I am very optimistic, and it's going to be probably still a long war. I don't know. I hope it's shorter than longer. But of course, I want to return. I am very lucky because I live most of the time now in Managua. And Managua is also my mother. Nicaragua is also my motherland. And I don't feel exiled. This is the same people, you know, and I feel very lucky to live there. But of course, I want to return. There are some certain smells. There are certain way of the people talking. There are certain faces that I remember, certain trees, certain colors that I think that are only unique in El Salvador. And I want to return, and I want to talk to my people, yes.
Is there a certain amount of guilt that you felt before you moved back to Latin America? Guilt that you weren't there with the people who were fighting against the military, and that you were writing about it from such a faraway distance where you could be more comfortable? I've heard a lot of exiles talk about something called exile guilt.
You are very perceptive, Terry. Exactly. I had the terrible guilt, especially when I was living in Mallorca. Mallorca, as you know, is a paradise. It's very beautiful. And we were living in a beautiful town, a small town with lots of artists, you know, painters, poets, everything. And I said, this is a paradise, but I felt a terrible guilt because I was not doing anything from my people. I have a poem that is called My Paradise of Mallorca, and I said that, yes, it's a paradise, but that every night that paradise is people with phantoms, and the phantoms were the phantoms of my guilt. So my guilt was so big, really, that when the Sandinista revolution triumphed, then my husband told me just 2 or 3 days before Somoza fled. My husband told me, all right, you know, you have been talking so much about this guilt. Let's go to Nicaragua then. Let's go to Nicaragua and write a book about Nicaragua. How about that? And I was so happy. And 6 weeks later, we came to Nicaragua and we lived there for 6 months, and we interviewed lots of people from, you know, comandantes and peasants and workers and everything. And we wrote this book that was published in Mexico that is called the Sandinista Revolution.
In some of your poems, you write about friends of yours who were killed or tortured.
Yes.
or maimed. And it reminded me of something that you write that your mother told you when you were young. Your mother had told you that you always needed to name the dead in your prayers so that they,
yes,
would be remembered, and so that they would be able to escape from limbo. In a way, your poetry reminds me of that, of like naming the dead, of keeping them alive, of...
That's right. You are completely right. That litanies that I don't do anymore, you know, that I said in Luisa, in Reality Land, in this. But I always remember my dead. But there are so many there, so many, that as I said in this poem that I just read, sometimes I feel like I am a cemetery, and that my dead friends are even more than my friends that are still alive, that there are more on the other side than on this side, and I always like to remember them. And I guess that's the thing, as you said, from my childhood, I don't ever want them to be forgotten.
Is it easier for you to write now that you're living most of the time in Nicaragua and that you're closer to your home?
Yes, it's very easy for me to write in Nicaragua. Very easy. And I am all the time motivated by many things. Yes. I am in a very good period of writing now. I don't have a block like I had for many, many, many times when I was living in Europe, for instance. A writer's block.
Can I ask you to read another poem for us?
Yes, of course. And this poem also I wrote when I was in Mallorca. It's called Toward the Jurassic Age. Someone brought them to Palma, the size of an iguana. They ate insects and rats. The climate was favorable. They started to grow. They left rats for chickens and dogs. They ate more than one lonely donkey. Children turned loose on the streets. The gutters were clogged as they fled to the fields. They ate cows, sheep, and kept growing. They tore down walls. They chewed up olive trees. They scratched their backs on jutting rocks until landslides blocked the roads. They leapt over the landslides, and now they are in Valdemosa. They killed the village doctor and, frightened, the people hid. There are herbivores and carnivores among them. The carnivores know one another by the military caps that crown their crests. But both are harmful. They devour plantations and carry fleece the size of supper plates. They scratch against walls until houses tumble. They are now in Valdemosa and can only be killed by rockets dropped from planes. But no one can stand the stench when one of them dies. The people protest that it is impossible to bury them.
You know, there are so many poets like yourself whose work is considered very dangerous in El Salvador. And I think it's almost difficult for North Americans to understand the power that poetry has in Latin American countries. Because I think in the United States that poetry has become relegated to what's considered to be a kind of obscure art, you know?
Yes, that's right. You know, for instance, about 4 years ago, my husband and I had an anthology of North American poets, and they started from Mark Strand, the young ones, Mark Strand, and ended with Caroline Forché. And when we finished the anthology, there were great poets, great poetry there. But we thought, after reading it all, my goodness, this is fantastic poetry, but it's with the exceptions of the black poets and some of the women poets, they were very individualistic poetry, sort of like a closed room poetry. See? I guess it's because North American poets don't have so much to fight against, I don't know. And in Latin America, it is impossible that you have certain sensitivity. For instance, in Central America, and a poet is supposed to have sensitivity, you are not aware of what happened right there all around you. And so that is reflected in the poetry. I think that's it.
Was it hard for you to figure out for a while what kind of poetry you could write that would make an impact?
No, and I never thought about that, Terry, really, to tell you the truth. As a matter of fact, I never go and write, let's say, a poem that is going to be a political poem or a protest poem. Never. Because I have such an awe for poetry, and I think poetry cannot deliberately be used for anything. But as I say, and then I realized that what I had to do was to write testimonies. And we have written, my husband and I, a number of testimonial books together. But as I said, I always, when I write poetry under the spur of obsession. And my obsession right now is my people in Central America, what is happening to them. And that's why it does reflect. But I always say my poems, I don't consider them political. I consider them love poems for my people.
You still write, I think, most of your poems in Spanish.
Yes, all of them. And then I never could write in any other language but Spanish. But my husband translates my poetry now.
How does that work out? You know English, so you can read the translations that he's written.
That's right.
It's very difficult, I think, to translate poetry to another language and get both the texture and the meaning.
Very, very difficult. I think it's a great challenge. I have translated poetry myself from English to Spanish, and I think no matter how good the translations are, there is something that is missing, like the odor, the aroma of the poem sometimes escapes. But I really think that I've been very fortunate because both my translators, Caroline Forche and my husband, Bob Flakel, have been great translations. They really are. And I have worked with them in translating my poetry.
I wonder what it's like when you read those poems in English, because the rhythms are going to be so different than the ones that
you wrote. That's right. It's a little different, but they have done beautiful things. They have captivated, I don't know how you said, capture. They have captured, the aroma. Yes.
So we only have about a minute left, but I'd be interested in hearing, now that you're living in Nicaragua, do you do a lot of poetry readings there? Is your poetry heard a lot or read a lot by people there?
Yes, very much. Nicaragua is a land of poets. And, all the time they are having poetry readings all over the country. It's so beautiful. We go, for instance, to very small towns, and there is announced that poets, that there's going to be readings, and we go in groups or sometimes alone, and the people are already there in the plazas under the sun, sometimes under the rain, waiting for the poets, and we go there and we read to them. Oh, many, many readings. Yes, Nicaraguans love poetry. It's a land of poets.